This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Saturday Magazine, sponsored by Velocity Rewards,
your award-winning loyalty program for Virgin Australia's frequent flyers.
Hey, you. Yeah, you, in the cafe. Did you know that over half of the people who listen to Joy are allies of the LGBTIQ+ community, just like you? So you may not be aware, but times are very tough financially at Joy, and we're reaching out for your support. Tell your next-door neighbour, your friends, and even your dad to head over to joy.org.au and help us build Joy Nation by making a donation. Joy, your voice, your radio station.
A unique mix of world news and queer culture. Saturday Magazine. Every Saturday, 10 till 12 on Joy 94.9.
Good morning. You're with Saturday Magazine with Taz and Janet.
We've got in the studio John Pizzuto. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Taz and Janet. Good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
It's great to have you back in the studio.
Oh, it's fantastic to be here. And I was just thinking, Janet, I worry about those planning days because all I think of is too many muffins and too many coffees by about 11 and I'm done.
Ah, well, actually, interesting you say that because I've now banned food in meetings.
Probably not a bad idea. I reckon it's a good goal to have at the end of your meeting. You've got to earn it.
Yep.
But when you can see there's muffins, there's tarts there and coffees on call, very dangerous territory.
People spend too much time thinking about the food rather than the task at hand.
Mind you, I think that it gives... We had a planning day for our board this week as well. I think it must be like board planning day season. And eating food gives you a time out to, regather a distraction.
It's creative, isn't it?
A useful distraction.
Can I be really radical and ask you, do you believe they're effective?
Board planning days?
Yeah.
Can't say that as the CEO when I'm...
John?
Look, I know you'll probably deride me for this, but I do think they're important because I think we have inflated expectations of what you can achieve out of them. So if you go there thinking that you're going to come up with the professional office equipment of War and Peace, then you're going to be disappointed. But if you go in there thinking, clean slate, I'm just going to hear things out, maybe make a contribution here and there, I guarantee you'll come out with one or two good ideas. But it's also important, I reckon, to understand that these things are ongoing. You can't think one session's going to be enough. It's
exactly
a regular
right.
thing.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So they are. I think they are effective if you know why you're doing it.
Mm. John, we've got a long list of topics we'd love to talk about with you, and I know you've got some thoughts as well.
I'll defer to you, though, of course, as always.
and we are interested in what's happening in the political landscape at the moment. We're interested in what's happening at a federal level as well as a state level, but I'm going to go straight to the federal level. Sports rorts, where do you think all that's going to land?
I think the Senate inquiry will be quite exacting for the government. And I think I said when I was last here that...
The Senate inquiry is important because it's a cross-party committee, isn't it?
Yeah, it'll be all sides against the government, effectively. If you adopt a reductive approach, it's everyone else. Sorry about that, listeners. If you adopt that approach, it's everyone else versus the government. But look, you're in government, you've got to expect that scrutiny. What I've always thought is it's probably not going to be pretty, but...
But it's not been pretty so far.
No, it hasn't. And what I've said, and what I said last time when I was here, was that I really hope out of this we have some broader reform and a change in culture about the way we allocate funding for local communities, because there's this real tension, and I won't go on too long about this, but there is a tension between opposition parties and governments going to the community and saying, look, we seek a mandate. If we're elected... This, in this seat, we're going to fund this. That's our commitment, and we'll do it whatever anybody else says. That's our commitment. For me, that's okay because you're being upfront with the public. You're telling them what you're going to do. But across government, federal, state, and local, there are billions of dollars that are allocated, and we don't really see how that happens. And governments of all persuasions have exercised political prerogatives in this space. And as I said, there are some times when that's okay. Other times when you think, well, maybe if you want to spread the funding equitably across the state without having too much regard to what your margin is in this seat, what hope you have of retaining that seat, that for me is a bit of a problem. So I hope reform comes out of this. But Tess and Jenna, I don't think it's going to be a pretty sight.
No,
say that.
No, I think the I think the most interesting thing for me in this whole exercise has been the most senior public servant's role in this, who was commissioned to do an investigation, did an investigation, arrived at a conclusion, never released his report, and we actually know about his relationship with the Prime Minister. Philip Gagens, who's the Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, has essentially been completely invisible in this, but has not really shown his hand. Now, I'm finding that a very interesting space.
Yeah, look, I know Phil Gagens. I don't know him well, but I know him. And look, he's a stand-up, you know, bureaucrat official. He has been chief of staff, and he's occupied political roles to Peter Costello. He's highly regarded, and I think in private conversations with people in the opposition and other parties, they'd probably concede some of that. But in these circumstances, in the tumult of all of that, do you go and appoint your former chief of staff and head of the public service to do a review? You can maybe make some arguments. My own political judgment would be, you know, being in my humble opinion as a private citizen now, is
a bit smelly.
You've got to expect, well, that's one view we're looking at, but even if you didn't take that view, do you want the grief that comes with people saying you're appointing your own most senior bureaucrat to do it? Now, it found a solution for the government to work its way through that problem.
Ah, but it's created another problem.
Yeah, well, that's my point.
The problem is around credibility, isn't it?
Yeah, and look, to some extent, it goes back to this kind of stubborn approach that politicians of all persuasions can take, that when you're in a difficult situation like the former minister was, if you just take a fairly, you know, self-effacing view of what circumstances you're actually in, if you just take the step you're ultimately going to be compelled to take anyway, just look at the circumstances early and say, is this a tenable position to defend? If it's not, go, and the government can get on with governing. But I think, as we touched on last time, when you dig a hole and you try and, you know, maintain the position, all you're really going to do is create more problems down the track, and that's what we're seeing now.
And obviously one of those problems is the relationship between the Nats and the Libs. You know, where do you reckon that's going to land, or how do you think that's going to play?
Gee, Janet, who saw that coming?
And is that really a stressed marriage or what?
Goodness me, and it right across the country now, I know I'm sort of digressing a little, going beyond the question, and I'll come to it in a second, but right across the country, there are different constituencies, very different, even in Melbourne. You know, the west of Melbourne is different from suburban, the suburban east is different from the southeast, is different from regional parts of the state. When you extrapolate that out right across the country, you've got Nats in Queensland who were just talking a different language to their counterparts in the south. And you look at people like, you know, Darren Chester, who I have the highest regard for, and I wish he were occupying a higher position in the Nationals, because I think he really connects with people at different levels. But you compare him, I won't speak for him, but in my sense, you compare him with, say, Barnaby Joyce, and you're talking two very different approaches. I think they would be the first to countenance that view themselves, but very different. And
I'm glad you said that and we didn't.
Yeah, it's very, you know, very different.
Comment.
And so, you know, I don't know how they're going to manage that over time, and it's for the government. I can only imagine they're looking plaintively and thinking, what can we do here? But put pressure on people to try and hold it all together. But, you know, the last few weeks, to say they've been identifying is an understatement.
Do you think McCormack will continue to lead the party by the end of this year?
I haven't got a clue. I can only tell you that I hope he does for the, as you'd imagine, being a Liberal, I'd hope the government can get it together and manage all of that instability, as difficult and challenging as that's going to be. But when you've got people who came out of that ballot the other day saying that it's not over, you've got to think, well, what kind of wish do you have? I mean, there's a kind of, I don't know, a death spiral, a political death spiral in some of this, that if you want to keep talking about disunity, well, the public, I can tell you from personal experience, having, you know, felt the tsunami after the leadership at the federal level in 2018, it is corrosive.
I'm actually very tempted to ask you to talk about your personal experience of disunity.
Well, at a state level, I think we were okay, Taz. We had some minor challenges, but we were pretty unified at the state level. At a federal level, it was impossible. And I've said this to people along the way, that I remember on election day, there were people who were, and this is an example of why leadership problems, for all the other problems they cause, I remember talking to constituents who were upset that Tony Abbott had been deposed, and then I was talking to constituents who were upset that Malcolm Turnbull had been deposed. You couldn't win as a state candidate. It's like saying to them, look, I understand your anguish, but we've got a state program of infrastructure and reforms to education, all that, but it didn't matter. Mm. That leadership is just consuming, and it arouses the most visceral responses, which are very human and very natural in constituents. But you can't talk people down from that.
Do you think people are getting a clearer idea of, or the discourse around what people want from a leader is changing? For example, during the bushfires, obviously, the Prime Minister struggled in his interactions with the community and the distressed community. Do you think that people are starting to say, well, we're looking for different things from our leaders?
Possibly. You know what I think that showed for me, that whole episode, is that there are some basic things you've got to do as a leader, and you've got a pretty wide berth on that. But if you get a couple of them wrong, then you'll be severely punished. And I think, you know, I think we've discussed this before, and it's been well rehearsed publicly elsewhere, but you know, the fact that the Prime Minister didn't come back straight away, it opened him up to criticism. I think he's kind of conceded that himself. And there are basic things you've got to do when something like that happens, a natural disaster. You've got to be on call straight away. And yes, it's right to say that you're not the one on the front line, but they still expect you as a leader to be there.
And his brand is, you know, ScoMo, the man who can slap you on the shoulder and make you feel good, and that's the brand, the baseball cap and so on and so forth. And I think that, I don't know, I'm my perception is that brand didn't live up to that brand during that crisis.
I think there's some truth in that. I think that was a very difficult period for him. It's going to take him some time to possibly, you know, work that over. But again, it's a lesson for all leaders that you can't be anywhere else but at the scene, not in the way of first responders, but you've got to be there. And just you know, I can say, as in the short time that I was a serving politician, sometimes just being there is what people are wanting. They know how to do the job, but they want to know you're there, that you have all of the empathy
and there was the contrast, of course, with the Prime Minister's absence, and then, you know, Daniel Andrews and Gladys and other premiers' presence.
That's very true, Janet. And they just tick the. If you think about the things I just said about what you've got to do, Gladys and Daniel just did those. So.
Now, if you've just tuned in, it's Janet and Taz here, and we're having a conversation with a political commentator and former member for Hawthorne, actually, Liberal Party member for Hawthorne, John Pizzuto. And we're having a great time chewing the fat about politics and stuff,
we
aren't we?
We are.
John, what's been the hot issue in the last week in the sort of, in the more local environment? We've been talking about federal issues, but more locally, what do you think has really grabbed the airwaves?
I would rate the Casey Council issue probably top of the local state type issues. The issue about infrastructure is bubbling along and seems to, for the government, be getting tougher and tougher. On the Casey thing, it was good to see that strong action was taken to sack the council, but it's got to be followed up now with real, I think, donations reform, and also reform to the way people in local government approach their duties. And what I mean by that is, it sounds like a pretty obvious and yet sweeping statement, but I think a lot of people go into local government in particular, and what they don't quite anticipate is, when you become a councillor, you're effectively becoming what I've called a kind of quasi-minister. You're making decisions involving potentially hundreds of millions of dollars, not only in terms of your own council budget, but in terms of the developments that are being undertaken in your own municipality. And I don't know that a lot of councillors who go in are ready for that. They appreciate the kind of duties around conflicts of interest, how you should conduct yourself when you're dealing with such sensitive issues. And so I think the Casey thing needs to lead to campaign finance reform. I think my own view is that councillor donations from developers needs to be stamped out. And I say that not because I think all developers, but they're not. Overwhelmingly, they're great. And they help build our city and build our infrastructure. I get all of that and I don't cavil with that. But for any councillor, you have to understand that if you're going to accept money from any developer, the problem with that is that you're going to be confronted with a conflict almost certainly. So why do it? You're not being elected so you can recuse yourself. That's the whole point. So I can't understand why councillors continue to receive them. And that's not to say that there doesn't need to be a change in culture at state and federal levels, but certainly at the local government level, I think this is something that's flown under the radar for far too long.
Do you think the government was right, the state government was right, to actually sack the council?
Yes. Yeah, I do. I think they were. Look, as a former lawyer, now practicing lawyer again, I do a bit of practice these days as well amongst my other endeavours. And I'm always for, you know, just withholding final judgment until you know the facts. And it's very hard in this environment now. It's very febrile. People are impatient for conclusions. They want findings. They want action. And it's very hard to ask people to forbear until you know the full facts. But I think in this case, we knew enough. My only, if I had any criticism, I think the government did the right thing and I support them. I wonder whether late last year there was a case for suspending the council, which is very common. We've all worked in workplaces where, unfortunately, sometimes there are issues and whilst you don't know the full
facts...
Can
they do that?
Yeah, there's scope under the Act to do that.
Okay, I didn't know that.
But in the scheme of things, I don't think too much damage flowed from not suspending them. I think they've made the right decision. And
well, they appointed
a
monitor, on the council. And they produced an independent report.
Yeah.
And it was formed the basis of government's decision to actually dismiss the council.
Yeah. And I think that was right. No, I commend the government.
Well, it's the right process.
Yeah. And it sailed through with bipartisan support.
Is that right? I didn't realise that.
The spokesman, Tim Smith, had called for their sacking as well. So the right decision was made. And I'm not trying to be churlish and all that. The government, I think, handled it reasonably well. I just wonder whether...
And, of course, a number of the people who were on council were, in fact, Liberal members of the Liberal Party.
That's true. Mr Woodman, who's at the centre of the most allegations, has also attended various Labor Party and Liberal Party functions over the years. So I think both sides of politics were careful about understanding that there were consequences that would flow by not taking strong action. So you're right about that, though. But it needs to lead to that larger reform and just a change in the culture. It's just amazing what happened there.
My view about these sorts of things, though, is what does this mean for punters? What does this mean for people who live in the city of Casey at the end of the day? Will they get better services, different services? I mean, what does it actually mean? And who really cares about a bunch of councillors?
Look, it's a fascinating question for this reason, I think, because the council's now going to be administered, right? It's going to be...
And that's Nolene Duff, former CEO of Whitehorse Council.
That's right.
A very experienced, very competent CEO.
Yeah, I don't know Nolene, but I understand that's her...
I've never met her either, but I
hear good things.
I went straight to LinkedIn and checked out her profile. She's pretty impressive.
But you know what unsettles me most about that outcome is that it's saying that it's not always going to work out when you elect people. So what does it say about local democracy? What does it say about democracy at a larger level? And, you know, we've probably all seen those references.
Who would want to be a councillor?
Yeah.
Janice?
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it's actually a really important level of government, though. I think that local government is responsible for a lot of our standard of living, you know, the built environment around us, but also, you know, garbage collection and a whole lot of other local roads and all the other things that it's quite an important level of government
and someone
to get right.
That's right. And someone would need to conduct the activity. But it really worries me that, it's another instance where local democracy has, failed. And so we've got to put in an administrator. And the administrator might well do a better job. that's what scares me.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's part of that overall erosion of trust, isn't it, that people have at the moment in lots of institutions, financial institutions, religious institutions, schools. If we think about St. Kevin's and the other news item this week.
Let's talk about that because that's actually managed to capture the airwaves for a number of days now. And it's caused quite a lot of upset out in the community. What are your thoughts on this issue, John? Do you think it was right for the principal to go and the other staff?
I think it was, and it's. Okay, I've spoken to a number of parents, and I've got a piece hopefully coming out on this in the next few days. But I think it was.
Can you say where so we can look out for?
Well, if I'm not sure when it runs, but I think with the Age, I wrote a column for the Age, so hopefully it'll come out soon. But I've taken the position that it was certainly the right thing. But can I make this point? We've had the Betrayal of Trust inquiry, from which a whole swag of bipartisan reforms to stamp out child sexual abuse have been implemented over the last 5 or 6 years. We've had the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse at a federal level. We've had affecting, heart-rending stories from victims and their families over 2.5 decades. The question I've got is, forgive my sort of colloquialism, how the hell did this happen? Right? What appetite? The community has no appetite for any of this. After all that's happened and all the work that's been done, how did this happen? Mm. And if, when you look at it in that sense, the principal had to go. There are two other senior staff members who are, you know, may well go. Mm. Again, I'm careful, particularly in the case of the deputy head, Janet Canny, who's contesting the claim against her. And fair enough, you want to contest the claim. You're entitled to do that. But, you know, the parents I've spoken to, deeply unsettled. There's a lot, like any school community, they love their school. They take greater pride and they learn about this and they... You know, disconcerting is just, again, an understatement.
Do you think it's sort of like a shift in community attitudes at some bits of the leadership, at least in that school, but in other parts of the community, the church, you know, some of the churches, for example, as well, which we're probably going to talk about in religious discrimination conversation later, but they haven't caught up with those changes. So we've had the Royal Commission, Betrayal of Trust, and I think the lawyer of the young man... who was on the Four Corners program was saying, you know, this they were doing this in the middle of the Royal Commission.
That's like, the bizarre thing.
It wasn't as though something that happened 50 years ago. It's something that was happening to these boys while there was massive community debate, but these men still, or the leadership of the school, didn't think it was about them.
Absolutely. I mean, and at the time these references were provided, we'd already had... the Betrayal of Trust inquiry, which was chaired by Georgie Crozier, mm-hmm. and on the Liberal side, and deputy was Frank Maguire from the Labor side, and a selection of parliamentary representatives on that inquiry. That had reported in 2013, or the response, mm-hmm. the government's response had commenced from 2013. So we already had that, and you're absolutely right, we had the Federal Commission underway at that time. And we've also had... certainly the Catholic Church, and disclosure, I'm a Catholic, but I can't tell you how disappointed I am in, you know, what I've seen over recent years of the way this was handled. To see another example of people treating it like, well, yeah, we can provide a reference here when it should have been absolutely condemned is beyond
John,
me.
We've seen the state government and the state government minister for education come out, step in and say they're going to have a look at this. I have heard a number of commentators say that this appears to be more prevalent, this sort of behaviour, in non-government schools. Is there an issue there? Is there perhaps not enough regulation and oversight over the performance of non-government schools?
You're preempting my column, I think.
Oh, dear.
No, it's good. I'm happy to talk about it. And hopefully the editors,
let us know what you're
saying. The editors won't mind. But this is the point I'm making, that, look, again, disclosure, our three young daughters went to a local primary government school. It was a great school. They've gone to a local independent school. So we, you know, I personally...
I presume somewhere in Hawthorne.
Yeah, somewhere
in Hawthorne.
Now, I support the idea of autonomy, independence and choice. That's an important part. We need both a strong government sector and a strong non-government sector. But, the point that really occurred to me during the week is that I think the point you're alluding to, which is... Guys, get your act together, because if you don't, the things that draw people to non-government schools, like independence and autonomy and choice, you're going to lose that. And with that inquiry now by the Victorian Regulation and Qualifications Authority, which I think is what you're talking about, Tass, that may well come out with recommendations about tighter regulation. And I know what the non-government sector is going to do is they're going to rail against that.
Of course they
and, will. And I'm saying to them, deal with this, get on top of this, because this is not good enough, and you're going to lose that. You're going to lose bits of that autonomy that are so important to the sector. So get your act together on that.
Chandler.
I think one of the interesting observations that I had from the commentary, and I think it was the principal who said in his resignation that that he'd really worked really hard in the interests of the school and the school community. And I think that one of the things that shifted in organisations that work with children and young people, which is what I work in, is that we can't work for the interests of our institutions. We have to work for the interests of children and young people.
That's exactly right.
And I think that's the shift that some of these institutions...
Who are we here to serve? Exactly.
And so I think his resignation letter, or the statement, as I recall it anyway, I hope that's what he said, but in my recollection is that it was something along those lines, that I think that exposes what the real problem is, which is that, and you see it in faith-based organisations as well, and service organisations, where they serve the interests of the organisation that they're working, banking, and not their customers or the people that they're there to serve. So it's that kind of that concept of service, I think, probably is what we're really talking about.
Couldn't have said it better. I mean, that's exactly right. And it's interesting because when I was in practice in a previous life, you'd often see that in organisations. There's just this determination, no matter what, to protect the brand. And to some extent, that's not a surprise. But the long-term damage and not being there to defend your staff and put them as your first order of business and your top priority means that everybody else looks at that and thinks, well, that's what you're going to do when we're in a difficult spot.
Well, you don't put your clients first, you don't have a business. I mean, if you put your staff first and but you're not looking after your service, the service that you're doing to your customers or your clients or the students or, you know, whoever they are, then it all falls apart or bad decisions get made.
I thought the resignation letter was a bit underwhelming, if I can use that term. Given the intensity of our collective reactions to what was made known.
John, we're going to have to search out your column in The Age, of course.
Well, I just hope it runs now.
Well, we've run out of time, so but it's always great conversation.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Just a completely different subject. I did hear a little story about you the other day. Ooh. Because I have heard you on Virginia Trioli's show on the ABC on Thursday mornings, and it's a great conversation, but somebody came back and said, hey, those two are too similar. It's going to create boring radio over a period of time.
Myself
you
and John
Bronwyn. Oh, you and Bronwyn, they're actually a bit too similar.
We're trying to jazz it up. We're trying to find areas to disagree.
You'll have to provoke each other.
That's right. You know what I really think of you, Bronwyn? Yeah, we'll do a bit of that. No, it's a lot easier when you're post-Parliament to be able to look at issues from different sides.
That was John Pizzuto, political commentator and former member for Hawthorne, Liberal Party member for Hawthorne. Wasn't that interesting? I think John's a really delightful person, really. I always enjoy having a conversation with him.
Yeah, and, some of his perspectives around what's happening in, councils and
quite
schools.
Quite refreshing, don't you think?
That's right.
Especially for somebody who sits on the conservative side of the spectrum. Quite refreshing perspective, I think, and he's actually not too shy about sticking the boot into his side as well, is he?
Yeah, well, I was going to say he's truly commentating about it, isn't he? Not just being partisan and running a line.
That's right.
Which is refreshing. We don't often hear that.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. Cool.
Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, proudly sponsored by Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.